Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Kropczyk. And John, Nicholas Lehman has been working on this book for some time, a book about the change in American corporate life that has resulted in our relationship with the business that we work at being attenuated in many ways. And you go back to the 1950s and the old company man with the briefcase and going to work, and there was a compact between the corporation and the individual that if you do well by us, we'll do well by you. The benefits will be great. They will accrue to you over time and even in your retirement. And a lot of that, John, has just vanished.
Well, I think you see it with the millennials now. They change jobs at the drop of a hat because there's no loyalty on the business side, and there's, you know, so why should they have loyalty to the company? I mean, you know, I can see that and I can feel that with companies out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how many people do we know of a certain generation who, you know, invested their entire lives in one place? And here in our community, we had big brass companies, Anaconda, Scoville, American Brass, and people were company people. And some even lived in company housing, if you recall that, John. We still have some of that, remnants of that in our community. So I think this does reflect what was going on at that time. But I want you to think about it in this context, because the book that we're talking about today is Transaction Man. And think about this. Let's go back to these large companies once offering all of these incredible lifetime security benefits, generous considerations. Now, I will say to you that while I'm saying all of this, we do know that environmentally, many of these same places, maybe not in an office park, were compromised. I mean, there's no question.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, the other thing is we didn't really know how bad we were doing to what we were doing to the environment, I don't think at that time, because we were just sitting there cranking out whatever, you know, whatever we needed to do to, we were a force in manufacturing.
Right. And of course, we didn't know because there weren't the protections. We didn't really think about the environment in that way. We kind of turned rivers into sewage dumps. I mean, really, we did some awful things. But
yeah.
Having said that, think about this, because I think this is really the takeaway point for this conversation today, and I really want you to listen to it, folks, because I think you're going to find it very interesting. What happened when that safety net that was put under so many people, from the worker on the factory floor to the executive offices, when that went away, guess what happened? It set the stage for the populist movement we have today. And the arguments we are all having politically about what is the role of government. Because once those were tethered and once, you know, they ripped apart, a lot of people were left in a void. And so there was a lot of anger, frustration. There hasn't been a lot of wage growth for the last 30 years. So here we are saying, well, I want the government to do more. And someone else saying, oh, the government should stay out of this. Well, what happens to people in the midst of that, when the company has pulled away?
Wow, I never looked at it that way, but yeah, that's you're right. I mean, you really had jobs with benefits. You never had to worry about these, you know, going broke, going to the hospital and everything because, you know, you had a good plan. You had a retirement plan that you didn't have to worry about now. It's do-it-yourself everything.
Well, now think about it, John. The argument has been Walmart is using the government through Medicaid to provide benefits to their workers. How many times have we heard that?
I know.
So the paradigm has shifted, and Nicholas Lehman understands that and captures it all in this book, Transaction Man, The Rise of the Deal and the Decline of the American Dream. Really important. Listen to it today on America Trends.
With me on the line is Nicholas Lehman, and he's written a tremendous book called Transaction Man, The Rise of the Deal and the Decline of the American Dream. And I've got to tell you, it was fascinating. You write this book more about changes that have swept our culture over a long sweep of time, but how appropriate is it that it comes out in the midst of what some consider the most transactional of presidencies of our history? Is that something you find quite interesting?
I've been working on the book for years before Trump had ever run for office. So I thought of the topic and the title prior to that. So it's about a kind of broader change in society. But he's certainly an example of it. And it's really in a couple ways. It's one, as you said, he's transactional. And two, it's a sign that the politics of the country has broken down. The book, the title of the book is a play on an old book called The Organization Man, which was written in the 50s. And it complains that the country is culturally too reverential toward large established organizations. And, you know, the political parties and would be an example of that, but only one. I think now the country errs on the side of being angry at and mistrustful of all the traditional major institutions, including but not limited to the political parties. And President Trump is president because he's a beneficiary of that.
Now, you begin in your prologue at the end of the Cold War, and all seemingly is going America's way. And yet we squandered that superiority. And let me quote from your book. Every item on the optimist checklist, including the most important ones, confidence in the future of capitalism and democracy, had begun to seem misguided. Take us back to that moment in time in the late 80s, and then we'll go back even further to get to the institution man who morphs into the transaction man. But what happened at that moment in time?
Well, first of all, I mean, a lot of your listeners may not remember that moment, but I do. Just to start with an anecdote, at the time I was working as the Washington correspondent for the New Yorker magazine. And the reason I was the Washington correspondent is the previous Washington correspondent quit in disgust because he said there's nothing to cover anymore because everybody agrees about everything.
Oh,
so
boy.
It seemed, and that, you know, after about 6 months, he called up and said, wait, I want to change my mind. But by then I was doing the job. You know, the items on the checklist were the Cold War had ended. So there was a sense, I think, misguided that there was a global consensus around, you know, kind of market capitalism and that economically everything was working well. You know, the end of the Clinton presidency was a pretty prosperous time. For what was really a brief moment, the world seemed to be at peace. You know, there was something called the Washington Consensus that at least economic writers used to write about. And the idea was the whole world has signed on to the Washington Consensus. Everybody agrees that the United States is the only superpower, and that's a good thing. There was a famous essay that everybody talked about at the time called The End of History. So that was kind of the feeling. And then that, you know, ended with a bunch of unexpected shocking events, including 9/11, the wars that followed 9/11 and have never quite ended, and the global financial meltdown of 2008, the following recession, and then following that, the big kind of left and right populist revolt globally.
But during that moment in time, there had been this movement away from the institution man toward this transaction man. And I think we have to go back to that. Let's go back to the myth of the 1950s, that it was a decade that was rather stale culturally. Conventionality was really here to stay. We all went lockstep and worked for a corporation. But when you review that history, you say some of those safeguards and some of the things that we built during that moment in time, which were big institutions, both on the federal level in terms of government, but also that as a check on big business, really yielded some very good results. Do many people understand what it is that your argument is about that moment? And do many others agree with you that that really was a time we should look at again with some hindsight?
I think, you know, if you're writing a book, you want to say something new and unfamiliar. So if pre the book people didn't agree with me, that's a good thing. Maybe I'll persuade them. I think I want to complicate the picture a little bit so it doesn't sound totally nostalgic. So first of all, the past is the past and you can't go back to the past. Second of all, in this sort of social order of the 1950s, it looked at the time very stable, in some ways too stable. If you look back on it, there was a lot more built-in instability than people realized in a number of ways. So number one, when Trump supporters wear hats that say "Make America Great Again," what they're referring to in part is, you know, a sense that back in the 1950s, people, at least people like them, could expect very secure lifetime employment and a better life for their children than they had, with the proviso that, and in particular, this would be true even if you didn't have a college degree, if you just had a high school degree. So that's just not true anymore. But this was, you know, first of all, it was a social order that really excluded a lot of people, people who were invisible, surprisingly invisible, even to liberal social critics of the time, African Americans, Latinos, women, etc. They weren't in on the deal, so that meant the deal had many fewer supporters than you might think. And the other thing is, as you said, it depended a lot on government. And once you withdrew government from, well, it depended on corporations functioning as a kind of welfare state in the way that government functions as a welfare state in Europe. So, you know, you needed government pressuring the corporations to take on things like healthcare and pensions that you know, were taken on by the state elsewhere. When government stopped pressuring the corporations and when the financial markets became much more powerful in the 1970s and 80s, they kind of forced that function out of the business world to a large extent. And that, you know, blew up the peace that existed around being employed in these big companies if you were lucky enough to be employed in them.
So you also had strong labor unions. You had a growing confidence, I guess, in the federal government to make amends for things that had gone wrong in the past.
Yeah,
and so
exactly.
It was a different time. And so the institution man, and believe me, I can picture it. I mean, I live outside of a city that was the brass capital of the world. As you say, many people who didn't have great educations, but they could certainly help to raise a family, one person, not two people. It was a different era. So we went from this institution man, and by the way, we're using the term man as just a kind
and
of a
fill-in.
And it's
justifiable given what the reality was at the time.
Exactly. But today, you're talking about now we had moved into this period of the transaction man, and thus the title of your book, Who is the Transaction Man?
Well, I think it's a sort of type, as was institution man or organization man was the title of the book by William White. So transaction man, who can be a woman, is somebody who, you know, tends to work in businesses that involve taking things apart rather than building things up, things like, you know, management consulting, private equity, financial firms,
venture capitalists,
capital, tech firms that pride themselves on disrupting entire industries. So in other words, such a person is trained to think that existing institutional arrangements are unhealthy and sort of sclerotic and hold up the good society, and that if you make everything faster, more fluid, and break things up, you'll get a better world. And that's a kind of core conviction about that such people have. And I speak as a sort of reformed transaction man myself, so I don't want to let myself off the hook too much here. And such people don't just apply this to what they do as a business. They also tend to apply it to how they would solve major problems in society. So in other words, if you saw a problem with the public school system, you'd say, okay, well, let's have charter schools instead of public schools, as opposed to let's fix the public schools. You know, over and over, there's a sort of attraction to the non-institutional solution to the problem.
Thanks for listening to America Trends. More in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
And you tell us the transaction man doesn't ascribe self-interest to his or her motivations. They feel very comfortable putting these notions forward and thinking that that their skepticism about organizations or large government really is warranted.
Again, I don't want to make all people in this category I'm proposing into human saints, but in my experience living in this world, it's a sincere but misguided conviction, not a cynical one. So, like, just as an example, one of the main characters in the book is a guy named Reid Hoffman, a big important figure in Silicon Valley. He's the founder of LinkedIn, one of the most important donors in the Democratic Party, or has been. And so when he looks at the political system, he thinks the solution to the problems of the political system are to end the political parties entirely. And he's very engaged in trying to do that. He's not doing it to help himself or to be selfish, but he is doing it because he really believes that parties are old and so they have to go, and a sort of fluid internet-based political system is going to get us closer to social justice, and that's what I don't agree with.
The book is called Transaction Man, The Rise of the Deal and the Decline of the American Dream. Nicholas Lehman is with us, and he introduces us in this book to some fascinating characters. Adolf Burl, who was FDR's man and very important, although less known as it relates to the institution man. Michael Jensen, an economist who was the key to the rise of the financial world. And as I look at it, you know, we used to scorn the notion that the middleman in a process, or the person who helped make these transactions happen, was the person that we should venerate in our culture. It was always the frontline person, the person working in the factory, toiling under, you know, really stressful situations. But a lot of the energy and a lot of the benefit in our society has moved to people who in the past were kind of seen as invisible in some way.
Right. So that's very true. And it's the way to understand it, or the way I present in the book to understand it, is it kind of, the story I tell starts with the New Deal, with Franklin Roosevelt taking office in an atmosphere of complete economic crisis and breakdown of the system. So he had huge electoral majorities, and he could kind of do whatever he wanted. And what he did was he put incredibly tight constraints around the financial world. So Wall Street became a fairly small boutique-y part of the American economy. And that was true all through the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and into the beginning of the 70s. It was one of the most regulated industries in America. Such people who arranged for trade, bought and sold stocks and arranged for stocks and bonds to be issued, were you know, when people would write about American society, they would treat these people as very kind of minor figures who were almost about to disappear. And then, you know, the game changed because the regulations that fenced in that world were taken away for various reasons, the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s. And the financial world became much more important. It became the sort of driver of economic decisions. And, you know, specifically, the culture around corporate CEOs having to dance to the tune of called by Wall Street analysts who want ever-rising quarterly earnings reports. You know, that wasn't the case for a really long time, and then it became the case late in the 20th century. And now, you know, a group of CEOs just produced a big statement saying they want to undo that overwhelming orientation to giving the quarterly earnings reports and being judged on that basis rather than on how they perform as members of society.
So the transaction man in your book goes from rising to falling, and it's not replaced, but it's supplemented because Wall Street still has a lot of power, even though during the meltdown, we can look back to Wall Street. Well, we can look to other institutions, too, as having let us down. But now there's this network man that you talk about in the book in terms of the sophistication of the technology world. I'm just curious about the overlap between Wall Street and Silicon Valley as being power centers on both coasts.
Well, it's interesting. So they're both power centers and wealth centers in a big way. Interestingly, in politics, both of them are not necessarily Republican conservative, especially Silicon Valley, which is, you know, fairly solidly Democratic. You know, Silicon Valley has an interesting relationship to Wall Street because these enormous fortunes that it has produced are produced by having access to the financial markets. But it's really a casino in the sense that almost everybody in that world isn't a winner. And then a few people are huge winners. And when they, you know, start companies that are hugely successful, they too try to be protected from Wall Street. So that's why, at least, you know, for the last several years, unless it changes, Google and Facebook are structured in such a way that their founders control the company. Their company is not controlled by stockholders. It's controlled by the founder-owner types. So there's some tension also between Wall Street and Silicon Valley.
But as you look at the transition from the transaction man to the network man, I mean, because you're looking at this in three phases in your book from the institution man on, where are we today? And what is the network man?
So I think we're in a pretty uncertain place, which I guess makes life interesting. So when I say network man, and that's referring to Reid Hoffman, he has a vision of how society is supposed to work. And in that vision, as we've been discussing, the institutional arrangements are loosening. His company, LinkedIn, deals with you as an employee. It's the business-oriented social network, or the social network oriented towards your economic life. And in his view, that's kind of the way the world should work, that instead of being, as in the old days, a lifelong employee of, you know, U.S. Steel or General Motors or whatever, you have a career that you manage through the network, and you move around a lot, you have a much more creative, flexible life. And then one step removed from that are companies like that Hoffman has been involved in founding, like Uber and Airbnb, where you're replacing traditional employment or a traditional economic sector with a kind of freelance sector. So the network man social ideal is that this is a good system, not just for the tiny number of people at the top of the companies that create all this, but for the average American, and that there's a whole new way that the average American would live that would be much better than, you know, the preceding eras. Now, that is an idea that really appeals to people in Silicon Valley. I do not think it's a reality that has happened for most people out there in the country, and I doubt it ever will. So instead of that, you know, what we have is we're back to life in the early 20th century, really, where this cycle, we're having a more fundamental debate about the American economy and how it should be managed than we've had in a century. So in other words, I don't think the network man ideal resonates with millions and millions of ordinary Americans who vote in elections. And what a lot of them seem to want is a more heavy government role in trying to, you know, structure the economy to create a better life economically for ordinary people. And that's why you have in the U.S. and globally big debates and a lot of energy and a lot of anger over these fundamental economic issues that, as we said at the outset, everybody thought had been settled. I would note that Trump himself, the reason he's president, the reason he got nominated over his 17 Republican opponents was that he departed from his party's consensus on issues like trade, antitrust, labor unions, Social Security, and Medicare, and took what would have been a traditionally more left-wing position on those issues. And then in the Democratic field, you have almost all the candidates are to the left on economic issues of where both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were. And two of the leading candidates, Warren and Sanders, are way to the left of any Democrat who's ever been nominated for president. So, you know, you're seeing a lot of economic dissatisfaction out there with whatever our social order is now. And the place it's going to look for relief is politics. And that's what's happening now.
And the millennials seem to be very comfortable looking to government to eradicate debt, to provide a safety net that is greater than it is today as it relates to healthcare. So the millennials seem to be grabbing a hold of this notion of, you know, letting government do more. Is that what you see? And what do you see coming in the period ahead?
It's not just millennials. It's a whole lot of people who, you know, by what we're seeing of election results, you know, all over Europe and the United States and elsewhere in the world, are willing to look outside the conventional solutions on economic questions, sometimes in creepy ways, like getting over-obsessed with limiting immigration, sometimes not, but all of these arrangements seem to be in play. So I think what you're going to see is a moment in the coming years when we kind of reinvent our political economy and what these arrangements look like, what government does, and all around, you know, the really fundamental question, how does a government guarantee a degree of economic prosperity, economic security, and a kind of a fair chance for the average person? There's all over the world, there's a sense that governments of all kinds have not been doing that. They've stopped doing that. And that's, to me, the big question on the table.
Thus, the concerns about liberal democracies. They just held a meeting in Halifax, and everybody seemed to be under siege. Well, thank you for helping us to put it into historical context in this century and the last century. Nicholas Lehman, Transaction Man, The Rise of the Deal and the Decline of the American Dream. I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofits.